200 years ago today, Illinois became the 21st state to join the Union. Back then, Illinois leaders were fighting over whether to ban slavery, expand it, or phase it out. Here's Illinois State historian Sam Wheeler.
The state that the great emancipator calls home, the state that the author of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, Lyman Trumbull, will eventually call home, their first constitution is a document that doesn't outlaw slavery, but it doesn't outright condone slavery either.
Plus, speaking of that history, we'll also revisit a conversation about the Underground Railroad in Southern Illinois and how that local history is being taught in schools. And remember this classic movie line?
Bueller, Bueller, Bueller.
As the state celebrates its 200th birthday today, we'll wrap up with some of Illinois' most popular movies. That's all coming up on this special bicentennial hour of the 21st. Stay with us.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and happy birthday, Illinois. Today, Illinois turns 200 years old. On December 3rd, 1818, Illinois became the 21st state to join the Union. Yes, that is why our show is called the 21st, in case you were wondering. This morning, we're bringing you some of our favorite bicentennial conversations that we've been having throughout the year. We're going to cover a lot of ground, everything from our first state constitution to Illinois' favorite movies to the Underground Railroad, and we're going to even play some music from Illinois musicians. Tonight, leaders and residents from around Illinois will gather for an official birthday party. Our outgoing Governor Bruce Rauner and Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker will make a joint appearance at Navy Pier's Grand Ballroom in Chicago. That event, by the way, will be hosted by Bill Curtis. If you listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you know who that I'm talking about. Here on the 21st, we thought we'd start with our state's first constitution. It was required for all territories that were hoping to become states. In 1818, the authors had some contentious debates over issues like separation of church and state and, of course, slavery. Sam Wheeler is Illinois' state historian. I started my conversation with him by asking why a state constitution was important for achieving statehood.
Back in August of 1818, Illinois is not yet a state. It's just a territory. And one of the requirements that the folks in the Illinois territory have to satisfy, they have to write a state constitution, and they have to submit that constitution not to a popular vote of the people, but they have to submit it to the United States Congress. The U.S. Congress would then, you know, debate the constitution to make sure that Illinois is satisfying that part of the requirement, and then ultimately, the Congress voted to allow the Constitution to be accepted and progressed Illinois further on that road to statehood. And so the delegates were tasked with creating a framework for state government in 1818.
Who was selected to be a delegate? Obviously, we're just talking about white men here, I'm sure. This is 1818.
Right. You're exactly right. In 1818, there was an election. Four delegates, people ran for the opportunity to participate in drafting the first constitution for the state, and 15 counties, and there were a total of 33 delegates that were elected to Illinois' first constitutional convention. They were all white males. It's staggering to think that only two of those individuals had actually been born in Illinois, but mostly this is a state of folks who migrated into Illinois, certainly. And these folks met for just 23 days, if you could imagine that, in Kaskaskia, the territorial capital of Illinois, and they drafted a pretty brief document. They were able to complete their task in such a quick way because they used other state constitutions, mainly New York's, Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky's, as models. And then they would have sessions where they would debate some of the sticky points, and then they would vote on these various measures. And my gosh, some of these things are really interesting that they were consumed with. For instance, they formed a state government that had three branches of government. That's no surprise. But there was a proposal. It was in the earliest draft of the Constitution to actually ban clergymen, ministers, preachers of the gospel from serving in the Illinois legislature. That was one of the proposals that the delegates debated. Obviously, it didn't make it into our Constitution.
Oh, that's interesting, though. That was an early iteration of a separation of church and state, and it sounds like a lot of people were very concerned about that.
It was. So that's interesting. In the legislature, you know, what I think as I go back and I look at it, they tried to use the most liberal terms possible in the 19th century in terms of defining who can vote in elections. And so, as you said earlier, this is the 19th century. They give the vote to male individuals that have lived in the state of Illinois for at least 6 months prior to an election. If you're over 21, you've lived in the state for at least 6 months, it doesn't matter if you're a U.S. citizen or not, you can vote in elections here in Illinois. That's an interesting proposal as well.
And that was part of the original Constitution, or was that?
Yeah, that's part of the original Constitution that makes it in.
Oh, so you didn't have to be a citizen to vote. That is really interesting.
That's right. In every constitutional convention, voting eligibility is always seems to be an issue.
How many people were in Illinois at this time?
So one of the requirements as well on the road to statehood would to take a census. And the first time the census takers went out, they found just about 34,000 people were living in the state of Illinois. That number's not good enough. They needed at least 40,000. And so they went out and they counted the folks again. And wouldn't you know it, they came up with 40,258, I think.
I shouldn't laugh. That's terrible. It's a terrible beginning to Illinois' history of corruption to inflate numbers. But
So I can't promise you that families weren't counted a couple times and people maybe passing through Illinois probably were counted, and families that you counted them in one county and then they moved to another county, they might have been counted. And so, yeah, the story of the population in Illinois at, you know, just before statehood, the good news is the population in Illinois really booms after that. So population becomes a bit of a moot point.
You mentioned Kaskaskia. Can you tell us a little bit about that part of Illinois and why that was the beginning capital area?
Oh, sure. So Kaskaskia, it still remains a fascinating place, very small. But Kaskaskia is that part of Illinois that's on the American bottom. It's in the southwestern portion of Illinois along the Mississippi River. And that's really the cradle of Illinois civilization. That's where the earliest Native Americans settled. And that's really where the French, who settled Illinois in the 17th century, that's where they established really their foothold in the Illinois country. And Kaskaskia emerges as the territorial capital during Illinois' territorial phase. A really interesting place. It doesn't remain the capital of Illinois very long after statehood. Of course, the state capital will move to Vandalia and then ultimately here into Springfield. Those changes sort of mimic the population shifts in Illinois. Illinois originally is settled southern Illinois, and over time, the population center really moves further to the north.
Sam, you mentioned some sticky issues. Slavery would have been the biggest one.
Slavery is certainly the biggest one. Think about Illinois coming into the Union as a free state. There are provisions in the first Constitution of 1818 that preserves remnants of slavery, indentured servitude, which really is just slavery by another name. Illinois' history with slavery is really interesting and not really well known. During the French period, they brought slaves into the Illinois country back in the 17th century. As the territorial phase really begins to evolve, indentured servitude, which, like we said, is just another form of slavery. These indenture contracts were pretty brutal. You could give someone your labor for X number of years. There are instances in which these labor contracts last for a person's lifetime. And of course, that's just slavery by another name. And so during the Constitutional Convention, they have to confront this. The Northwest Ordinance, which Illinois carved out of that territory, it calls for the ban of slavery. Yet the Congress is telling territories like Illinois, you can create your own state and you will enjoy all the freedoms and all the liberties that all the other states enjoy. Well, to some folks in the 19th century, that means they should have the liberty and the freedom to own other human beings. That's just a reality of American history. And so there are intense debates that take place in the lead up to statehood. And so at the Constitutional Convention, there's compromises made over this issue. So for instance, in the first Constitution of Illinois, folks who are servants, indentured servants, they are still, their status will remain that way under the Constitution of 1818. But their children, for instance, they'll be free upon adulthood. So it's not a perpetual institution in a sense. There's the mechanism for gradual emancipation built into that first Constitution in Illinois history. So You know, think about it. The state that the great emancipator calls home, the state that the author of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, Lyman Trumbull, will eventually call home, their first constitution is a document that doesn't outlaw slavery, but it doesn't outright condone slavery either. It's a complicated position the folks in Illinois carve out in 1818. But what I also like to emphasize on this is it's only the law of the land. The Constitution of 1818 is only the law of the land in Illinois for 30 years. It's a very specific document written for a specific moment in time by a population that is really dominated by folks who are born south of the Mason-Dixon line. Probably about 75% of the population were Southern-born. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention, maybe about a third of those delegates are actual slave owners themselves. And so by 1824, the conversation in Illinois reaches a boiling point on this issue of slavery. There is a movement to make Illinois a full-fledged slave state, and that movement is defeated. And that really puts Illinois on the road towards living up to that title as a free state. But of course, it doesn't quash the debates in Illinois that sort of mimic the national debate at large, the struggle, fundamental struggle in American history over freedom.
How many other times has our Constitution been updated then? So you mentioned 1818, then 1848.
So there's constitutions that are written and adopted 1848, 1870, and 1970, and that's the constitution that we currently are living under. There's been other calls for constitutional conventions, most notably during the American Civil War. There was a constitutional convention. The constitution was not adopted by the people. And again, a similar process took place in the 1920s.
That's Sam Wheeler, Illinois' state historian. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to a special bicentennial edition of the 21st. By the way, a quick update on today's state government. Last week, we talked about the veto session in the General Assembly. They wrapped up on Thursday, and many bills have either failed or passed. The proposal to raise the tobacco sales age to 21 failed by 9 votes in the House. That means the age stays at 18 for now. One bill that did pass is called the Voices Act. Immigrants who are living in the U.S. illegally and are victims of domestic abuse, human or sex trafficking can apply for a special visa when they help law enforcement investigate these crimes. Now, Illinois has set new standards for that visa process, with Governor Rauner's veto being overridden. Andy Kang was one of the advocates behind this bill. He's executive director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago. Hey, Andy, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
This was something that you all had advocated for as part of the overall Trust Act. Can you remind us again what the point of this bill is?
This idea actually originates all the way back to 2015, when many community organizations discovered that a lot of service providers that work with domestic violence, sexual assault, and trafficking victims were having difficulty applying for what's called a U visa. And this is a federal program. It's a voluntary program, but it's meant to encourage immigrants who are victims of crimes, major crimes, to step forward and report those crimes. And then all that is required as part of this process for the application to be considered by the federal government is that a local law enforcement authority would need to certify that, in fact, yes, this individual stepped forward and reported a crime and is likely to continue to cooperate with the investigation. And unfortunately, the major problem was either due to misunderstanding or just not having the information, a lot of law enforcement were not certifying these requests. And so we had a lot of survivors that were not getting the support and help they needed to get free of a bad situation.
And to be clear, this is only for people who are involved in situations involving human trafficking, sex trafficking, domestic violence?
It could apply to other crimes, but what we've seen historically over the many years that this program has existed, those are the primary folks that benefit the most from this avenue of relief. And so it's something that we really felt strongly needed to get done. We passed it with bipartisan support this spring. House Republican leader Jim Durkin, as well as State Representative Barbara Wheeler, who was a co-sponsor, they agreed that this too was a public safety issue. We tried to depoliticize this and not make it a campaign issue. And so we're very happy to see that a lot of those same supporters showed up this fall to override the governor's veto.
Andy, when we're thinking about people who are here who are here illegally, people who, whether their papers have expired, they're undocumented, are those groups then especially vulnerable to these crimes?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that we heard a lot from the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence. You'll have an abusive or a dangerous situation, and the abuser, oftentimes someone with some level of immigration status, will hold over the person that they're abusing the fact that where are they going to go, right? If they report a crime, they're going to get deported. Oftentimes there are children involved, and so that's used as leverage. And so the importance of this bill, I cannot say enough, this will absolutely help hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals get the help that they need, so that that kind of leverage, that won't happen, and they'll be able to get free of a really bad situation for themselves.
Andy, I remember talking to you when this was originally part of the Trust Act, and you were really frustrated and upset that Governor Rauner vetoed this. How do you feel now that his veto has been overridden?
Yeah, you know, we were very optimistic about our chances, but you just never know. And I have to say it's really a relief, but also something that people are very happy about. You know, we felt that the governor's veto wasn't something that, you know, was based on facts, but it was something that was done, you know, in the heat of an election campaign, and that has its own reasons for doing that, but we didn't agree with that. And so this is definitely a law that is going to make a real difference in making Illinois safer and helping a lot of folks that need help from law enforcement. And I'm supremely proud of the group that we work with, all the organizations and community groups that helped the Campaign for Welcoming Illinois get this done, but also the legislators that really stepped up. And in particular, we saw a lot of female Republican House members have the courage to step forward and say, you know what, we're not going to let this one become a partisan thing. We're going to support this. I know folks are oftentimes suspicious whether anything can get done in the Illinois General Assembly. I think this is a perfect example when a lot of political considerations are put aside and people just do the right thing.
That's Andy Kang, Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago. As he said, part of a big group that lobbied to have the Voices Act take effect. When will this take effect, Andy?
So this passed in the veto session, overriding the governor's veto. So this law would take effect next year.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and on this special 200th birthday of the state of Illinois, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations about Illinois' past and present. Later this hour, we'll hear about some favorite Illinois movies. You just heard about the early history of our state and how its leaders decided to address the issue of slavery back in 1818. In the run-up to the Civil War, slavery was still allowed to continue in many parts of Illinois. And the black men and women who were free were in danger of being kidnapped and sold into slavery across the border in either Kentucky or Missouri, especially if they lived in southern Illinois. So some African Americans decided to form their own communities. One of them was called Miller Grove, and local historians and archaeologists have been learning more about the role they and other African Americans at the time played in resisting slavery, including as part of the Underground Railroad. That history is finding its way into local school curriculum. Stacy Taft and Rachel Bocci are teachers at Murfreesboro High School. Grant Miller is an associate professor in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at SIU. I started by asking Grant to tell us what life was like for the free black men and women of southern Illinois in the 1840s.
Southern Illinois was pretty notorious nationwide as far as the amount of kidnappings that were occurring. I mean, there are several different articles, like, for example, in Gallatin County and elsewhere, where there were basically free, as one article points out, free colored children of the ages of 18, 17, 9, and 5, who were basically taken from their parents in broad daylight. Few citizens did anything about that.
Oh,
and so you had very, very kind of treacherous situations for a lot of people in this area. A lot of violence, a lot of kidnappings were very common.
Wow. With that in mind, what do we know about these communities like Miller Grove that were formed?
Well, I mean, we know, for example, of course, a lot of instances we had from as many settlers, white settlers, to southernmost Illinois were from kind of the upper south. We had a lot of individuals, as the case with Miller Grove, who were emancipated, who were freed by their slaveholders, maybe in a will or by death. and were allowed to basically settle in this area in southernmost Illinois. And what's interesting is how close a lot of these communities began to form, so close to these borders with, of course, what were still slave states, being Kentucky and Missouri at the time. So there are several of these communities that popped up. Miller Grove in particular formed in 1844 with 68 free African-American residents, and it was pretty common at the time. That was very typical of a lot of the communities in this area.
And what did it look like? What do we know about the communities in terms of, were they basically just sort of like little towns or little settlements, or how did they interact with, I guess, white neighbors or white populations?
Right, right. So a lot of times more like settlements, so several farmsteads that might have been kind of grouped together. Miller Grove was actually kind of considered more of a settlement with these families. And as far as interaction is concerned, a lot of that was on a minimum, except for what was also popping up in this time, which is has suspicious ties to the Underground Railroad, were a lot of white abolitionist ministers, a lot of those who are associated with the American Missionary Association. So you had that springing up and its connection with the African Methodist Episcopal churches that were springing up in this area as well. So a bit minimal in terms of interactions with a lot of white residents in the area. But we see from these archaeological digs, I mean, there were interactions where people, you know, with these digs finding artifacts from interactions with buying things from nearby Golconda or other places of that sort. So there was some interaction, but I think it was kept on a minimum.
That's Grant Miller, who teaches at SIU in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction. We have two Murfreesboro high school teachers on the line with us to explain how they've been teaching this in their classroom. Stacey Taft, to Grant's point about artifacts, how are you using those artifacts to teach this history in your classroom?
Having access to the artifacts, especially in the 3D printing, gives the kids a whole different perspective, because instead of having artifacts that are in a museum that you can look at or that are locked away, they now have a print of that artifact that they can touch and feel and look at and analyze. When you take that, put it together with the geography, put it together with the newspaper articles about the acts of violence, they can start to form their own idea of what was happening, what was going on, and start questioning the things that they've always known that's in their textbook, or that this is just how it was. You know, Illinois is a free state, but if it was, then why is all of this happening? It kind of is a really nice bridge between geography, archaeology, and history that allows the students a lot deeper thought.
And what are you 3D printing, Stacey?
We have a glass medicine bottle that came from Miller Grove. We have ceramic doll parts, like a leg and the bottom of a leg with a boot and a bonnet, a spoon, slate board, which shows that there was probably some form of education happening in these communities, a revolver, a buckle that shows like a harness buckle that shows the agricultural ties. So those are the ones we have right now. Hopefully we'll have more soon, and hopefully we'll be expanding this to other situations and other parts of history as well.
Rachel, what do you teach the students, and what do you know about the role that African Americans at the time played in resisting slavery, including playing a part in the Underground Railroad?
Well, this year we've kind of taught it, starting with these primary sources and artifacts that Stacey has talked about. I think it's been really eye-opening for our students to realize what was happening in their backyard with these sources that they, you know, they can relate to all these counties. They're right south of us, southeast of us. I mean, I think it's just really good for them to make connections also from this time period to our whole civil rights movement unit that we've been doing, so we can make some connections as to what was happening and how quickly is it changing and how quickly is legislation being passed to stop these things from happening and these rights and things to,
yeah, why is it important, right, to kind of make that connection, right, Rachel? So you're talking about something that happened in southern Illinois nearly 200 years ago with the civil rights movements of the 1950s and 60s.
Well, I think it's important because for them to realize how long of a process it was, and a lot of people think, like, just after the Civil War, like, everything was fine, everything was better, slaves were freed, but to kind of show what was happening before the Civil War, what was happening after, and then what's still happening in the 50s, 60s, and even today in some parts, just kind of looking at some hints of racism and discrimination and things in different places in southern Illinois, or why certain areas are predominantly African American while others are still today predominantly white, and where the history of that comes from and why they may have felt more comfortable settling in certain places in southern Illinois. And I think the more connection you can make to current history or to their lives, as we've talked about with other units and this unit as well, I think it's really important and it's really eye-opening for them.
That's Rachel Bocci, who's a teacher at Murfreesboro High School. We've actually got a student with us as well. He's a junior at Murfreesboro High. Josh Ruiz is with us as well. Hey, Josh, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you.
Josh, were you surprised to learn about this history that took place pretty close to where you grew up?
Yes, I was. I mean, I know that, you know, all around the Midwest, you know, there have been, you know, tons of sites where there have been many things linked to, you know, segregation and things like that. But, you know, just to know at the Grove that they did the dig sites at, just to know really what came out of that was very, very eye-opening to, I think, a lot of us.
Yeah, what's the most interesting thing you've learned from this?
I think the most interesting thing really has to be about really the proximity, how close we really are to the Underground Railroad, things, you know, that were right outside our backyard.
And Grant, when we think about the role the Underground Railroad played, can you tell us a little bit more about what role the Underground Railroad played in this area?
Right, and that's what's really fun about, I think, a unit such as this, because it's an incomplete record. So we have, you know, instances where historians will say there was no Underground Railroad in this area, because they will correctly point out there are no sources that directly point to this. However, historical archaeologists and others are putting together a lot of different sources to kind of begin to look at the contrary. And so that's why in this curriculum we have a GIS map that just shows the amount of activity that was occurring in this area. So it varies considerably. I mean, as far as Miller Grove is concerned, there are a lot of suspicions that we have. For example, they found at one of the sites a piece of printer's type. So that begs a lot of questions. You know, was there a printing press at Miller Grove? In the oral history, in the oral tradition, there is nothing mentioned about that. However, was there a printing press for abolitionist papers? Was there a printing press to print false freedom papers or what have you? But what is in the oral tradition with a lot of these oral histories about Miller Grove from former residents in the area and so forth are a lot of these things that, as I think Stacy pointed out earlier, point to geography, which is really fun. So, for example, Crow Knob in the oral tradition is where a large bonfire would have been set to direct runaways to Miller Grove who were coming across near Golconda. Sand Cave, which is a large kind of cave in the Shawnee National Forest, is from oral tradition a place where a lot of runaways were hidden. It's a large cave, and you could fit probably 200 or 300 people in there. But, of course, these different aspects that we have from oral tradition begin to at least present new questions or new ideas about the Underground Railroad. And that's what's great about this unit, because it is not just this one story, but there are multiple stories. And through these primary sources, students get an opportunity to kind of build that history themselves.
Josh, what's been the most interesting primary source that's been brought in for this unit for you? Is it these 3D printed objects or the maps? What's the most interesting thing you've learned from this?
In my opinion, the most interesting by far has been the 3D printing images that we have, you know, we have in our own hands. I mean, granted, they're not, you know, the literal digs and that the stuff that they pulled out of the ground, but it is a piece of history right in our hands, and I think that's really what it's all about.
Stacy, you mentioned the archaeology as how this sort of brings together all of these things. And as Josh is talking about and Grant as well, what role are the students, is archaeology playing in this? What are you teaching the students about what's, I imagine, still being uncovered at these sites, it sounds like?
We look at the plot maps. So they start to get an introduction to how an archaeological site will work and how the sites are measured off and squared off and the record keeping that's involved, where the artifact was found in this particular unit. And what does that mean? What was this? Was it a school? Was it a church? Was it someone's home? So we start by just having them think like archaeologists. What does this mean? How do we interpret it? And then go into, okay, this was a home. And obviously, you know, you have some hog's teeth found here and you have a revolver found here. So this is probably the smokehouse or the kitchen area. And then go into, what does it mean with outside contact? You have this African-American community within miles of a sundown town and a very where a lot of violent acts are happening or a lot of runaway slave ads are running. Do they risk going and buying this doll for their child in this community? What kind of contact? What does that mean? What risks are they giving? And so just being able to analyze these different perspectives. And I think for me, the most rewarding part, and just hearing Josh say that, the teacher in me gets all emotional, but is they're thinking outside of what a history book says. History books are one version of history. This allows them to question what is in that book and what history is, and is being rewritten daily. That we find new artifacts, we find new sources, we talk to people who have a different oral history, and history is evolving. And I think for them to see that, my hope is that they will carry that out of school and learn to not just question everything at face value, but what, this may be my perspective on it, but somebody else's perspective of this may be different, and to have a more eye-opening view of just the community and the culture in general.
Grant, as you help develop this curriculum at SIU, this model is called Educating with Evidence. To Stacy's point, when did you? I wonder when you first looked at history, the way history is taught, and thought maybe there's something missing here, or we need to keep adding on to our layers of understanding of what has happened.
Right. I mean, it's a great question, because when I graduated high school, I thought I was quote unquote good at history. Why? Because I could memorize names and dates, and I thought that that's what it meant to be good at history. And then kind of going through, you know, as we might experience in other forms of education, looking at different perspectives and different ideas, you start to realize that history and past are not synonyms. Past is what happened. History is what's written about that past. And that does change, as Stacy pointed out. And then there's just been a lot of work in this area as far as like with educational researchers and teacher educators. And we're looking at ways that kind of basically help students explore multiple and conflicting sources, analyze the credibility, the reliability of those sources, corroborate those sources, and then kind of synthesize those to form an argument. I mean, ideally, that's what anyone's going to do living in a democratic society when they're like getting ready to vote for a candidate. You're bombarded with multiple and conflicting bits of information. This is also media literacy. So that, and kind of our education communities, has gained a lot of momentum. And honestly, it's showing up in standards as well. That's what shows up in the Common Core. Common Core State Standard 1 is cite evidence to support a claim. You can do that with any curriculum. And so that's what we've been really digging into, is to help teachers kind of explore ways that they can bring more of that into their classroom and to have students engaging in this kind of exploration of history that is beyond, you know, read chapter 13 and answer questions 1 through 5 at the end that are just comprehension questions.
And Rachel, too, Josh's point about just how he learned about how close this was to his, you know, where he lives. I wonder, when you're teaching this to students, I wonder if you even have African-American students who maybe could see this is maybe where their ancestors came from. I mean, are you finding that students are learning more about their history as well?
Yes, definitely. Our school is, I would say, half or predominantly a little bit over half African-American. And it's interesting and pretty amazing to watch their faces kind of light up as they make connections to their own past, because a lot of times the history of different minority groups kind of get left out or kind of get talked about briefly or in only one perspective or one way from the textbook, or they have a little paragraph or something about their history. So I think it's going to be really great to continue diving into this more, as Stacy said, as we continue to find stuff. And I think that they do relate to this, as well as it kind of gives a different eye-opening experience for white students as well. And I think it's important for students of any race to be familiar with,
yeah,
you know, these
with
histories.
All of this. Thank you so much. That's, yeah, Rachel Bocci, Stacy Taft, both of them at Murfreesboro High School. I want to thank Josh Ruiz, a junior, and Grant Miller at SIU. Thanks for being with me. Coming up after the break, we'll dive into some of our state's best movies. Let's get you in the mood with this famous music. And if for some reason you don't recognize what movie this comes from, I'll tell you where it came from when we come back from the break.
Come on, oh baby, don't you wanna go? Look there, brother, baby, and I'll see what I see.
Chicago.
One, two, three, four. We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight. We would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We certainly hope you all enjoy the show. And remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there's still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody. Everybody.
Everybody. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and that, of course, is from the 1980 film The Blues Brothers, which, by the way, is also where we got that Sweet Home Chicago music just before the break. It's an iconic Illinois movie, and it's also the winner of an online poll put out by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Throughout this year, the museum has been working on a project called Top 200. 20 top 10 lists have been voted on and tallied, everything from top athletes to top historic sites to top heartbreaking moments. Today, as we celebrate our state's 200th birthday, we're looking back at Illinois' top movies, including Blues Brothers, which came out on top. Back in March, we spoke with two of our friends from the Lincoln Library and Museum. Chris Wills is their communications director. Christian McWhorter is a research historian. I started by asking Christian if it was any surprise that the Blues Brothers was number one on the list.
I'm not from here. I grew up in Canada, and the Blues Brothers was probably the first time I ever saw Chicago or Illinois was watching that movie as a kid.
I think it was probably the same for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was the same thing for me, too, because I didn't grow up in Illinois. I grew up in Miami, and I think I thought Dan Aykroyd was probably Chicago and Illinois when I was a kid.
Right, and he's from Canada, too, right? So there you go.
Oh, no. All right. Well, Christian, we already know this movie was set in Chicago. I wonder if you, and Chris, you can hop in after this, but what do you think this impact of the film was when it came out in 1980 and then after that?
Well, I can tell you one of the things was it really exposed a lot of people to the music the Blues Brothers were covering. A lot of those songs had gone out of print, and it kind of created this impression of Chicago as a place where the blues kind of thrived and got introduced to the world, which is really true and is something Illinois and Chicago should really be proud of.
Chris, do you remember the first time you saw the Blues Brothers?
Yeah, I do. And I remember at the time thinking it was really dumb. All these car crashes and driving through a mall and these guys kind of, if not ripping off, at least sort of capitalizing on classic music. But as time has gone on, I've really grown to appreciate its charms. Yes, it's silly and cartoonish in a way, but it really has a heart. You know, it's about these two guys who are pretty shady, but they're trying to do the right thing. And that's kind of Illinois' image in the world, so it seems very fitting.
Kind of shady, but has a heart.
Trying to do the right thing, you know?
Well, number three on this list is A League of Their Own. And a reminder for everyone, this came out in 1992. At the time, the very A-list stars of Gina Davis, Madonna, and, of course, Tom Hanks. Let's take a listen to A League of Their Own.
Say, Evelyn. Can I ask you a question? You got a moment?
Mm-hmm. Which team do you play for?
Well, I'm a peach.
Well, I was just wondering, because I couldn't figure out why you would throw home when we've got a two-run lead. You let the tying run get on second, and we lost the lead because of you. Now you start using your head. That's that love that's 3 feet above your ass. Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
That's A League of Their Own. That was, of course, Tom Hanks playing a baseball team manager yelling at Biddy Schramm. The movie's actually about the real-life All-American Girls Pro Baseball League. Christian, what do you think the significance of A League of Their Own is? Because at the time, it was really, I think, groundbreaking, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely, in that not only did it highlight something that was, like, specifically women's history, but I think the women's league in the 1940s had been all but forgotten. And so it just led to this huge revival of interest in this, I mean, really cool women's sports story. And, I mean, there's just not that many movies about women in sports out there, right? Still.
Yeah, there still aren't. That's a good point. And, Chris, I think there's no crying in baseball. It's kind of one of those pop culture lines that's just stuck around, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's on one of those lists that they do every so often of the top this or that in movies. It's considered one of the top 100 quotes in movie history. So it's really stuck around.
And in that clip, Biddy Shrimp's wearing a team jersey with a badge that says Rockford. Christian, can you remind us of the movie in terms of Illinois, where that's set?
Yeah, they're the Rockford Peaches in Rockford, Illinois, just, west of Chicago. So a true Illinois story.
Okay. Now let's move on to a certain Illinois movie that I'm going to guess is the most well-known in this illustrious list. It came in second after this online poll. Let's just go ahead and hear it.
Adamson.
Here.
Adler.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Bueller. 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 Bueller.
He's sick. My best friend's sister's boyfriend's brother's girlfriend heard from this guy who knows this kid is going with the girl who saw Ferris pass out at 31 Flavors last night. I guess it's pretty serious.
Thank you, Simone.
That, of course, is Ferris Bueller's Day Off, starring Matthew Broderick. If for some reason you've never heard of this, it's about a kid who pretends to be sick so he can skip school and have a dream day with his friends in downtown Chicago. I'm talking to Chris Wills and Christian McWhorter from the Lincoln Museum and Library. Chris, what are your memories of this, of Ferris Bueller?
Just the ingenuity and daring of Bueller in his escapades, trying to figure out how to fake a day off, how to get away from school. So it really symbolized somebody who was smart and daring enough to do what they wanted to do. And then, of course, it showed off Chicago. It made it seem like such a great wonderland to wander around in and see all these different sights and take part in all these different activities.
And I remember a couple of years ago, there was a really great Twitter account that was pretending to be Ferris and was recreating his whole day and taking pictures of the whole day. And I think it kind of brought back for everybody how much they love about this film. So Christian, I'm going to need you to defend the honor of this movie here, because part of the reason this came in second place in your poll is because Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune did some of his own online lobbying to make sure it didn't win. It is all in good fun. He is not a fan of this movie. He wasn't able to make it today to come on the 21st, but he did leave us his voicemail explaining his thoughts about Ferris Bueller.
Hey, guys. Michael Phillips here at the Chicago Tribune. My hometown is Kenosha, Wisconsin, but, you know, what can I do about that? I'm calling about the whole debate about what is really Illinois' top movie. And, you know, the fact that Blues Brothers beat out Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I guess that's a good thing. I do prefer that movie. But it's got to be something like either Call Northside 777 with James Stewart, or Haskell Wexler's Medium Cool, or really my favorite of the ones that were nominated, His Girl Friday, which was filmed in, of course, Burbank, California, not anywhere near Chicago. But it is the greatest of the adaptations of The Front Page, which is the quintessential Chicago play, and that was the best film version of it. So I would vote His Girl Friday, but, you know, I can live with the Blues Brothers. I would not have been able to live with Ferris Bueller had that won. I would have had to move back to Kenosha.
All right, that's Michael Phillips, the Chicago Tribune's film critic, giving us his list of Illinois movies. Christian, why is Michael wrong about Ferris Bueller?
Well, I love Michael Phillips. I really do. It's an honor to be even virtually on a show with him.
It's okay. I'm trying to start a fight between you two, as you can see.
He's absolutely right that Ferris Bueller is a movie about, like, kind of an adolescent jerk being an adolescent jerk. And my defense of it is, it was at precisely, like, when it came out, I was at the right age to be, you know, an adolescent jerk. And so it was like a perfect movie for, like, someone of that age to, like, see. And just, it's a power fantasy for, like, a high school kid, right? And it really plays well that way. I think it has more heart than he gives it credit for. But yeah, I've got a real soft spot for it. I loved that movie growing up. I loved all John Hughes movies. But, yeah, Ferris Bueller is kind of a cut above. So that's the best I can do to to try to defend it. And it makes Chicago look awesome, right? I tell you, I didn't live here at the time, and that movie made me want to go to Chicago and see it. It looks like a great place.
Yeah, no, I'll agree with you on that. Chris, one of the movies Michael Phillips mentioned is called His Girl Friday. This came out in 1940. I know you were talking to our producers earlier with your personal favorites. You had His Girl Friday on your list. What do you like about that?
Well, I'm a former reporter, so this is a movie about reporters chasing a story, doing anything for the headlines, and in the process trying to keep a poor guy from being executed for a crime. So it's fun. The comedy is great. It's the fastest paced movie ever because the dialogue is so fast, and it just captures such a wonderful Chicago flavor. So it's just always been a favorite of mine. It's really worth seeing. And you know, I would like to respond to one thing that Michael Phillips said: is Blues Brothers the best movie about Illinois? Is Ferris Bueller's Day Off the second best? No, but we're asking people what the top movies are, and we're letting them define that however they want. Maybe it's the one that seems most quintessentially Illinois to them. Maybe it's the one that means the most to them on a personal level. So I don't think we have to think of it as best. We can just think of it as the tops, the one that the people of Illinois like the most.
Or we could think of it as popular versus what a film critic would pick.
Too.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. All right. So before we end, we're almost out of time, but we have, Christian, your personal favorite that you sent us, 16 Candles by John Hughes.
It's a brand new year. I'm 16. Everything should be platinum. I should be happy, right? Right?
Yeah.
Well, I can't get happy. It is physically impossible for me to get happy.
Christian, you mentioned John Hughes earlier. Why do you think that John Hughes for you represents sort of a lot of this iconic popular Illinois?
It's funny, you know, his movies, they're all set in Chicago, although Chris, I think, pointed out earlier that there's a lot of them could be set anywhere, but the fact that they are all in Chicago, I mean, there is a kind of, you know, I don't know, they kind of touch on a kind of universal experience of what it was to be a teenager or, you know, growing up in the 80s. And there's a lot about 16 Candles that is not defensible at this point. But,
right. Yeah, especially at this point.
It hits. Yeah, Long Duck Dong, especially. Yes, it's not defensible at all. But and The Breakfast Club is surely a better movie. But again, I'm just, you know, as like Chris said, we're talking about favorites here, movies that had an emotional, you know, resonance for you. And I was at just that right age for like John Hughes movies to really hit me in the sweet spot, and they really, you know, reflect what it was like to be a white, you know, middle class person growing up in the 80s. And they'll always have a little special place in my heart.
Well, we've got the whole list. We'll tweet out that whole list for everybody. If you're looking for something to watch this weekend, I want to thank Chris Wells. He's the communications director at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Christian McWhorter, research historian. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, thanks for having us.
That does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, I'm off for the rest of the week. Liz Westfield will be sitting in for me. Tune in to tomorrow's show to hear her. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows. You download it, set your home station, and if you search for The 21st to follow us, that's how you can listen to past programs. And if you want a podcast, we're available iTunes, Android, wherever you get your podcasts. All those links, if you want to contact us, leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us at social media, our handles are all listed at our website, 21stshow.org. That's where you can find our Twitter handle, our Facebook page, and if you want to ever leave us a voicemail, all that's there too. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.